This is the Publix Radio. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez. This Saturday, the United States Army celebrates its 250th anniversary. Trump is honoring the day with a military parade, the first such event since the end of the first Gulf War in 1991. Millions across the country are expected to hold No Kings protest in response. We'll talk with organizers of two local protests. Also, the Providence NAACP is practically shut down. The president and all the officers were suspended by the national NAACP. We'll get an update. And for Artscape, we meet local artist Jordan Seabury. He has a new webcomic called WTF Can Artists Do During a Fascist Takeover? All that and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. On Saturday, protests against the Trump administration are expected across the country as part of the No Kings National Day of Action. It coincides with a military parade in Washington, D.C. to mark the 250th birthday of the United States Army. And there are local protests scheduled, too. We're joined now by two organizers of the No Kings Day protest in Providence and Fall River, Lev Poplow and Kevin Costa. Lev, Kevin, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Lev, remind us again why the event is called No Kings Day.
Well, if you remember back in the campaign, when our current president was asked, do you want to be a dictator? And he said, oh, yeah, on day one. Well, apparently he meant it. If we look at the way he's been running this country and his administration, he rules by fiat, executive order. He bypasses the legislature at all times, although it appears that the legislature, which is controlled by his party anyway, is perfectly happy to let him do that. So he's acting like a dictator. He's acting like a king. And we're here to say, no, you're not a king. You're not a dictator. This is America. That stuff doesn't happen here, will not happen here, and we're going to stand up to you to make sure that you know what your place is in this country.
The protest in Providence, where's it going to be held? How many people are you expecting?
It's going to be held at India Point Park from 1 to 3 p.m. It's hard to say how many people are going to show up, but I would expect somewhere 3,000 to 5,000 people.
Kevin, how about you? The protest in Fall River, where's it going to take place?
It's going to be a visibility event at the intersection of William Canning Boulevard and Newton Street. Also, it's near the entrance to the South Coast Marketplace. And this event is going to be what democracy is. We're going to be talking to each other through peaceful persuasion, sharing our insights and perspectives, and walking away with a deeper and broader perspective of the political realities we face.
Because I want to get a sense of, like, what do you hope to accomplish from this? Lev.
So we have lined up a series of speakers, some of whom are very well known, some of whom are taking a public platform for the first time, who are each going to speak for a short period of time about an issue that Rhode Islanders are feeling directly based on the things that are going on in D.C. So we've got people who are going to talk about health care, senior issues, labor issues, immigration, and what's going on with ICE. That's obviously very important as well. We've got someone who's going to be talking about income inequality. So each speaker is going to be bringing with them a call to action, something that they're going to be able to say to the crowd, hey, if you want to help our organization, here's the help that we need. So our goal is that you never know who in this crowd of thousands of people is going to respond to which message. We want them to feel motivated to continue taking action, to continue pouring out in the streets, to volunteer with some of the organizations.
We're seeing a lot going on right now in Los Angeles, protest right now on the ICE raids. A lot of protests have been peaceful, but there's always that fear of clash with police or law enforcement. No concerns about that for this weekend?
No, I'm not concerned with that. We've been lucky in Rhode Island. And don't get me wrong, ICE is active in Rhode Island. There's no doubt about it. They have picked up people. They have arrested people. They are holding people. But we have taken necessary steps to ensure that we have security. The Providence Police have worked with us on every action that we've done so far. They've been very cooperative and supportive. We will have our own marshals on site as well, many of whom are trained in nonviolent de-escalation techniques. So we don't anticipate something happening, Luis, but if it does, we'll be ready and we will respond with nonviolence.
Some people would argue labeling the president as king is a bit dramatic, may downplay the constitutional checks and balances designed to keep him in check. Well, so what do you say to that, Kevin?
You know, we have institutions and laws, and you know, we have an inheritance from the past. You know, people have struggled. And this is an act of freedom, and we shouldn't take this for granted. This is something that we just take for granted in the United States. It's an inheritance from those that have passed on the torch to us, and it's our obligation to not take those freedoms for granted and preserve them and pass them on to the new generations.
Lev, same question to you. Again, I'm going to give you the pushback because I don't have that voice, but
that's fine.
People would say, we're overblowing this.
Right. Our systems of checks and balances is not functioning. Period, end of sentence. The Constitution very clearly defines what the President's responsibilities are in Article 2, what the House and Senate's responsibilities are in Article 1, what the responsibilities of our Supreme Court are. And yet none of those checks and balances seem to be functioning right now. Isn't no kings overblowing it? No, I don't. Frankly, I think it should be stronger. I think it should be no dictators. It should be no fascism. Because when your system of democratic checks and balances fails to work, then we no longer have a functioning democracy. Now, some people may look at me and say, did you just say we don't have a functioning democracy? And the answer is, on one level, yeah, I did. The House and Senate are supposed to provide oversight functions to the executive branch. Do you see that happening? I think that the no kings label is not an exaggeration. If anything, it's not strong enough because our system is not holding up.
Let me finish with this. I want to hear from both of you on this take. I want to get a sense from you. Do you think protests work? How far do you think what you're doing is going to go? Kevin, go ahead and respond, please.
Well, I've got some good friends who are Trump supporters. They'd give you the shirt off their back. And, you know, and in a democracy, it's not factionalism. That's what we're in danger of falling into. This isn't against our fellow citizens, including those who voted for Trump. You know, there's decent human beings. And in a democracy, party comes from the word part. So even if you're a partisan, you always recognize you're part of a larger whole. So we're not against, you know, the people who might have voted in a way that we think they were mistaken, but we're trying to peacefully persuade them to think, you know, to rethink and to think of the consequences of, you know, the path we're on with this administration.
Lev, same question to you. Why does this matter?
Echoing Kevin, we live in a free and open society. You know, people have asked me, well, why is this what you're doing? And my answer is always, I'm not an attorney. I can't file a class action lawsuit. I am not a legislator. I cannot pass laws to make this stuff go away. But what I can do is I can organize boots on the ground action, because the more boots are on the ground, the more elected officials have to listen to the people of this country. So no, I don't think protest alone is going to change the situation, but I think it's very important that our political leaders, that our business leaders, that all the leaders of every sector of this country understand how the American people feel about this. And that's where protesting comes in. It gives the average person the chance to have a voice and a say beyond just a vote.
Lev Poplow, Kevin Costa, organizers of the No Kings Day protest in Providence and in Fall River. Gentlemen, great conversation. Thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure being with you and with your audience. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more from The Weekly Catch after this break.
Our Town, produced by Rhode Island PBS, is visiting all the towns in the Ocean State. Our next stop along the way is Tiverton. If you're interested in being part of Our Town Tiverton, be sure to join us for an informational Zoom meeting on Wednesday, June 25th at 5:30 p.m. For more details, visit ripbs.org/ourtown. That's ripbs.org/ourtown. Thank you.
This is the Public Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. Our political reporter, Ian Donis, joins me now to break down the week in Rhode Island politics. Ian, always a pleasure.
Hi, Luis.
All right, Ian, a $14.3 billion budget is headed to the Rhode Island House floor next Tuesday. What stands out for you?
Couple things. No one knows if Republican budget plans in Washington are going to blow a big hole in the Rhode Island budget. That raises the possibility that lawmakers might have to come back in October for an unusual fall session to make some changes. Of course, Rhode Island's budget has grown dramatically over time. Now it's $14.3 billion. About 10 years ago, it was roughly $8 or $9 billion. So there's a question about the expense of state government. The budget's also noteworthy for including more money for Rhode Island's healthcare crisis. The crisis is so severe that it's not going to be solved in a single year or even 2 or 3 years. This could be remembered one day when the state started taking some significant steps to address the healthcare crisis.
The Rhode Island Ethics Commission has given the okay for Senate President Val Lawson to lead that chamber and the NEARI Teachers Union. What's the thinking here?
Well, the commission found there's no per se conflict, which is good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far because a legislative leader, like the Senate president, has a lot of power over which bills get voted, appointments, things like that, and the commission did not really look into those aspects of it. John Marion told Patrick Anderson of the Providence Journal that he was disappointed the commission did not consider those aspects of it. But we've probably not heard the last of this. There are particular bills that could cause President Lawson to recuse herself, and she has stepped back from some legislation even recently because of this issue.
All right, finally, former state senator Cynthia Coyne this week announced a run for lieutenant governor. Why did she announce more than a year before the election?
Well, Cynthia Coyne clearly wants to get a jump on other candidates who are expected to get into the race for lieutenant governor. The current incumbent, Sabina Matos, is seen as potentially vulnerable because of a controversy that went along with her previous run for Congress in the 1st District. Cynthia Coyne left the state Senate by not seeking re-election in 2022. She is from Barrington and a former state trooper, and I think she's hoping to elevate her profile by getting an early start and a jump on some of the other candidates.
How many people do you expect in that race?
That's interesting because if it's a really big field, it could work to Sabina Matos's advantage, but I expect at least a few more.
Ian, always appreciate the updates. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
For more politics news, you can listen to the latest episode of Political Roundtable or read Ian's TGIF column out every Friday at 4 p.m. For over a century, the Providence branch of the NAACP has been a leading voice in the local fight for diversity and equal rights for people of color. But internal strife has been plaguing the organization in recent years. Concerns surfaced in 2022 following the election of a former branch president who has since been convicted of violating state campaign finance laws and is now facing accusations of financial impropriety. In addition, all other local officials were removed by the national NAACP. Here to talk more about what's happening is Steph Machado, who has been following the story for the Boston Globe. Steph, it's such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
A lot to unpack here. Let's go back to November of 2022 when Gerard Katala was elected president of this branch, the Providence NAACP branch. Who is Katala? Why his election has been so contentious? What's going on?
Well, at the time that he was elected president of the branch, he was already a sort of controversial figure because he was under criminal investigation by the Attorney General's office for violating campaign finance laws in multiple runs for Providence City Council. He's run 3 times for City Council and has lost in Ward 9. And the Board of Elections said they did an audit of his campaign finance account. They found that thousands of dollars that had gone into the account was not accounted for, and that thousands of dollars spent from the account were not accounted for. Again, it is state law that you have to itemize all of those expenditures to prove that they were spent on legitimate campaign expenses. And so that is why he was referred to the Attorney General's office. Ultimately, he was charged and convicted of violating campaign finance laws just related to his 2022 run for city council. The 2018 race was beyond the statute of limitations. But to this day, he has not cleared up those campaign finance issues with the Board of Elections. They tell me he owes tens of thousands of dollars in fines because they fine you every single day that you don't file these reports. And he was, again, convicted of 2 crimes related to that, which he is appealing to Superior Court.
2 years ago, Several members of the Providence branch of the NAACP attempted to initiate an effort to have him stripped from the presidency. Why wasn't that effort successful?
Well, I don't know about the internal goings on in terms of whether they got enough signatures on the petition. What I will say is that his tenure, his two-year tenure as president of the NAACP, was constantly marred by these issues, by his criminal trial that took place while he was president, and then questions about whether he was the appropriate leader of the organization. People told me that they had stopped going to meetings, that they weren't receiving minutes. People told me that they signed up for a membership with the NAACP, but then had never received any sort of confirmation that they were a member or emails about the membership. And that was why the election for a new president this past fall was canceled, because the national office was concerned that there was basically voter disenfranchisement, because people said they were signing up for the Providence branch of the NAACP, but not receiving any emails and apparently weren't going to be able to vote in the election.
Other advocacy groups like the Black Lives Matter Rhode Island PAC said as far back as 2023, they'd refused to collaborate with this Providence office as long as Katala was president. Considering the heat that he was under, why didn't he just resign?
You'd have to ask him that question. I've asked him, you know, many times in his... He's always said that he's never done anything wrong. He has consistently denied his campaign finance violations, even after he was convicted. Again, he is appealing that conviction, and he has told me that he has not done anything wrong when it comes to his tenure as president of the branch. What the national office has said is that they did an investigation into the branch, and we should say that the national office has now taken over the Providence NAACP branch. It is not operating locally at the moment. And they said that they found issues that they felt the need to report to the Providence police. The Providence police tell me that those issues were related to finances, and they therefore referred them to the FBI because of the jurisdiction, you know, multiple jurisdictions being involved. And so we will see what the FBI finds.
So with no president, no officials, is the branch basically defunct? I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly several months ago when Mr. Katala was suspended, it felt particularly defunct, right? I mean, the website was down. The Broad Street office, their most recent office location, had been emptied out, vacated. They were given an eviction notice after the landlord tells me they didn't pay rent for 6 months. They were basically not operating. There's not meetings taking place. I think now, as of last week, when they had this emergency meeting where the national office announced that they had removed all the officers and that they were investigating, now the hope is that the national office, in this intervention that they're doing, will get the branch back into a healthy place where it can actually function again. But it is not functioning right now.
Has the controversy, though, around Katala hurt in any way their ability to raise money and get secure grants?
Oh, I'm sure. You know, back when Katala was elected president, the attorney general withheld a grant that he was going to give to the NAACP because he said, well, this person cannot manage finances based on his own investigation. So I'm not going to give a grant to him to manage money for the NAACP. So I do think there will be like some reputation rebuilding that needs to take place. If it is only Mr. Katala that was the issue, and again, we do not know what the results of this investigation is going to be, but because he is removed, if there are new officers elected, perhaps the public and other groups that might give grants to the NAACP will feel more comfortable doing so.
I'm wondering what you're hearing because of Katala's reputation and everything that's happened and everything that can unfold. Do you think this has permanently hurt the reputation of the Providence NAACP?
It has certainly hurt their reputation. Whether that is permanent, I can't say what's going to happen in the future. I think they have a lot of rebuilding to do. They need to bring people who have stepped back from being members. I've spoken to a lot of members over the last 2 years, and people have told me that they either canceled their membership or they just stepped back. They stopped actively participating because they weren't comfortable with the leadership. And these are people who had been there for decades and decades and decades. So if those people decide that they're going to come back in and be part of the fold again and really try to make it into the great, important civil rights organization that it has historically been, then I think they can probably reinstate their longtime reputation.
Again, what happens next?
I think the main thing is what is going to be the results of the criminal investigation into Mr. Katala. We will see if any charges come from that. And then, as we were talking about, will the NAACP return to its former place in our community? You know, it was a major, major voice on Black issues, but civil rights for all people. And in this current political climate, what's going on in Washington with diversity, equity, inclusion, a lot of people have told me they really wish the NAACP's voice was here to speak about it.
I've been speaking with Boston Globe reporter Steph Machado. Steph, it's such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more for the Weekly Catch after this break. This is the Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez, and it's time for Artscape. A local artist poses the question, WTF can artists do during a fascist takeover? That's the title of a new webcomic by Providence-based artist, educator, and organizer Jordan Seabury, who spoke with Artscape producer James Baumgartner.
So, Jordan, what's your answer to the question, what can artists do?
The first thing we can do is we can choose a side, and we can choose to put our artistic practices to service for that side. People think a lot, artists in particular, think about polarization as the enemy, as an obstacle. And I would love to be polarized against fascism.
Could you read the first few panels for us?
I spent the winter in Guatemala. I returned to the States after the inauguration and the first few weeks of the new regime. ICE was hunting people down in the streets. Life-saving federal aid was frozen. The Department of Education was about to be destroyed, and my painting studio was being sold to luxury developers. For once in my life, my obnoxiously endless optimism had run dry. I felt powerless.
That panel, the I felt powerless panel, is vivid. You have a self-portrait in the bottom left-hand corner. You're looking up. Everything is red and black and brown. Arrows and lightning bolts are pointing at you. Tell me a little bit more about this panel. It feels sort of like an inflection point.
This panel really describes what it felt like to come back to the States after the administration had already begun some of its early actions against immigrant communities in particular, but as well as the academic left and just poor people generally. And so this feeling I had coming back and trying to wrap my head around this place that I had left just a month ago that looked really, really different. There were ICE Gestapos snatching up my neighbors. People were in Central Falls afraid to leave their houses. There were nonprofit organizations trying to make contingency budgets in case all of their aid got slashed. I mean, it was such a different landscape that I knew I needed to go back to square one just to try and wrap my head around it. That sense of overwhelm, that sense of shock and awe is something that they want to inspire in us. They want us to feel so off balance, so uncertain about what we can do, if anything, that we don't do anything. It's a really effective tactic to make people feel too scared and too overwhelmed to leave the house.
The comic goes on to suggest some things that artists can do. What are some of the basics here?
So first is to remind ourselves as artists that we are human beings as well, that all of our expressive power isn't just in our poems or our paintings or our compositions, but that also our artistic practices put us in rooms with people that we can build power with. So one of the first things that you can do if you have an artist studio that's shared with other people is begin to build power with those other folks. Host conversations, host hangouts, and begin to break down some of the overwhelm that so many folks are experiencing. Beyond that, I would love for folks to be thinking about unionizing their artist spaces. That's something that we did at the Atlantic Mills. But first and foremost, artists should remember that we're people. And so just like anybody else, we should think about how do we build people power with the folks around us.
It sounds like a lot of these things, you don't even need to be an artist in order to do them.
Well, that's the joy of it. It takes some of the pressure off of your artistic practice from having all the answers. You don't have to make a painting that solves every aspect of the climate crisis because you are also a human being. And making that painting puts you in touch with other human beings and the natural world, and you can solve problems there as well. Part of the thing I find with artists is that we get so overwhelmed trying to solve problems exclusively in artistic practice that we forget that we're also around people all the time. We're around systems all the time, and we can build power there too.
Jordan, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have this project on your platform.
That's just part of our conversation with the artist, organizer, and RISD professor, Jordan Seabury. You can hear more of that, as well as reviews of the latest plays at the GAM and Trinity Rep at thepublicradio.org/artscape. Artscape producer James Baumgartner joins me with a few recommendations for the week ahead. James, what's going on?
Well, there's a grand opening party for music store Empire Guitar on Saturday with several musical acts performing, including Courtney Swain, the Red Door Trio, and Oliver Ackerman. The performances start at noon and run throughout the afternoon. This is at Empire Guitar's new location on North Main Street in Providence. Saturday is also the Gatsby Days Parade on Narragansett Parkway in Warwick from 10 to 1. It's the annual celebration honoring Rhode Island's role in one of the earliest events of the American Revolution. There's also a colonial encampment that you can check out on Saturday and Sunday in Patuxent Park. And then there's the ceremonial reenactment of the burning of the Gatsby in Patuxent Cove Sunday at 4 p.m. And Thursday is Juneteenth. One of the events going on around the state is the Taste of Juneteenth Festival. This will feature the foods and food cultures of the African diaspora with more than 24 vendors. It's all at Farm Fresh on Sims Ave in Providence from noon to 6 on Thursday the 19th.
Lots of great stuff. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Lewis.
Before we end our show, the U.S. House of Representatives this week passed a measure to claw back already approved funds for public media across the country. For us, that means losing about 10% of our budget. But it's not over yet. It'll need to pass the Senate to take effect. If you value the Weekly Catch and everything you hear on the Public's Radio, now's the time to show your support. You could do that by making a financial donation, talking with your friends about what public media means to you, and posting on social media with the hashtag #StandShareSupport. You can learn about more ways to take action at protectmypublicmedia.org. That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of the Public's Radio. Our assistant producer is Joe Tasca. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our editors this week are Mareva Lindo and Jeremy Bernfeld. Our chief content officer is Sally Isley. And our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.